You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, April 28th, 2010, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Hi, everyone.
Yo.
May 1st, guys.
It's May 1st?
Yes.
Kind of.
4 days before Cinco de Mayo.
Listening to this, it's going to be May 1st.
Oh, I can't think that far ahead.
Of course
I live in the moment, man.
Halfway to Halloween. Halfway to Halloween.
Of course.
Well, what do you got?
But 1924, the first iodized table salt in the United States went on sale at a grocery store in Michigan.
Really? Table salt? Yeah. That's where you're going?
Okay, well, here we go.
Wow. What a shitty day.
No, please go on. Right. This is fascinating.
The table salt. What did the table salt contain that no salt contained prior to this?
Iodization.
Iodine.
Yes, very good.
A desiccant.
Yeah, it was
0.01% sodium iodine.
The answer is in the question.
Why are they putting that in there?
It's a good question, Steve. Why did they put iodine in the salt?
Going to
homeopathic remedy, something like that?
Because, it prevents goiters.
Right. That's right.
Who gets goiter?
To reduce the incidence of goiter.
Goiters.
And it just was one convenient way to make sure people were getting enough iodine.
It was.
Do they take it out now? Is it still in salt?
No, it's still in there.
Because goiter is such a huge problem.
You haven't had any goiters lately, have you?
You're right. I never have. My goiter is fine. What is goiter?
Large thyroid gland.
Thyroid, especially around the neck.
Thought it was a steel beam.
Do you guys know which episode this is? What number SGU this is?
I don't even know what day this
is. We're over 200. I know that.
Yeah, it's like 230. 230.
250.
250.
Oh, geez.
250.
250. Oh,
250.
Quarter of the way to 1,000.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, the 20th anniversary. Like, 1,000.
We'll talk about anniversaries next week.
We are just 1 week away from our 5-year anniversary. That'll be next week.
Ooh,
oh,
wow.
Really?
Yeah, it's 5 years of SGU.
What is that? Is that, that's platinum, right?
I think it's the balsa wood.
Well, podcasting years, we could be at our silver already. Right?
No, I think send me a ship in a bottle.
No, I think it's Einsteinium.
And April 22nd, 20 years ago, what happened?
20 years ago?
22.
I don't know.
90.
Oh, Hubble Space Telescope went up.
Oh, yeah.
Duh.
It was a segue.
20 years of Hubble.
Wow. Hubble, you rock.
Hubble. Well, I have something to say about the Hubble telescope.
Yeah.
It totally kicks ass and continues to kick ass.
And even more so. Good. I mean, it just puts out better and better images as they upgrade the software and they swap out some of the instrumentation. The lens is the same, but just the instruments, the computer equipment has gotten so much better in the last 20 years that, the images it's producing now are just stunning.
Oh, how are we going to update the Hubble after they stop sending
We're
up?
Done, dude.
It's over.
It's had its last update.
It'll be like a Mars rover. We'll just use it until the last little image is sent, and then we'll be like, that's it.
But if it's functioning better now than it ever was, why are we giving up on it?
Because we won't have a shuttle after the end of this year.
What about private shuttles, What about
Yeah, 50
yeah,
years.
Yeah, maybe Richard Branson will go up there and fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
hey, Richard. Here's your screwdriver.
That's true. You think about it. A private company could go up there, claim it as salvage, recharge those batteries,
and then start selling
time off of it.
You know how long that would take to get a private company up to speed to the level to go and do that kind of very detailed work?
Who's going up now? China's going up. Russia's going up.
Yeah. Soyuz capsule, silver flies.
Bugs Bunny.
India? Didn't they
India's
have a space
trying.
Program?
They have a space program.
Wasn't really working out so well.
And, the Western European countries send craft out there.
Yeah, Europe. So happy birthday, Hubble.
Happy birthday.
Yay.
Bob, tell us about nanodots.
Yeah, you just had to forward that one to me, right? It says nano on it, so therefore.
You salivated, didn't you?
Yeah.
Bob will take that. He'll take any nano story. Well, this one deals with a library on a chip. We've all heard that one before, right? Well, now they're talking about it again recently. A North Carolina State University researcher, Jay Narayan. Hey, Jay. He claims that using his nanodot memory chip, he should be able to store an unprecedented amount of data on this chip, something close to an entire library, he's saying. But they don't say how big that library is, though. Well, they kind of do indirectly. The nanodot that they're talking about here are basically tiny nanoscale magnets made out of some sort of crystal that's perfect, defect-free crystals. And they basically, I think what they're doing is they're taking these crystals and embedding them in the silicon chips. And they're all one of the key things is that they align them perfectly. So they're all kind of pointing in the same direction. And then apparently you'll be able to program them. You'll be able to write and read from them programmatically. So this guy, Jay Narayan, said that we've created magnetic nanodots that store one bit of information on each nanodot, allowing us to store over 1 billion pages of information in a chip, in a square-inch chip. So that's pretty amazing. This guy, Jay, he's the John C. Fan Distinguished Chair Professor of Material Science at the North Carolina State, and he has also authored the research. Now, to put it in perspective, he's saying a billion pages of information per square inch. So I assume that, say, a page has got 10,000 bits, which I think is conservative, 10,000 bits on one page. So that's 10,000 times a billion pages. So you're talking a 10 trillion bits per square inch. You have to go to hard drives before you really start making anything comparable. It was kind of hard. It was surprisingly hard to find what the state-of-the-art hard drive has in terms of density. But what I could find was something close to maybe 300 or 400 gigabits. Some of the new hard drives are talking about, they can get 500, 700, 800. Billion bits, maybe they're talking a trillion. So still, that's still 1/10, 1/15 or so of what this guy is claiming. So,
hey Bob, are you just counting the actual surface of the storage area, like, you know, when you say the disk or the platter inside a hard drive, versus the size of the chip that he's talking about, or are you
talking about the density, the amount of information per square inch?
Okay.
Per square, that's the key. It's apples to apples. It's all these numbers I'm quoting are all per square inch.
Okay.
So a hard drive platter obviously can store a lot more than, because that's 329 billion bits per square inch. So there could be a lot of square inches in one platter. So the cool thing is that they claim that these can be made rather inexpensively, but the weird thing was that they said they need to develop a way to interact with the nanodots, perhaps using lasers. That seems to be, that's a key thing to me. Like, well, it's great that you made these nanodots, but if you have no way to interact with them, you might not be even close to this. So I don't know how long it's going to take,
Wait a second.
How long?
Did you just say that we have no way of reading the data?
That was my take from it.
Or writing it, apparently.
Yeah, from what I gathered from the articles I've read, that they need to determine the way to interact with these nanodots. So that seemed to be a major little piece of the puzzle missing. And they're not even sure how they're going to do it. They said, oh, maybe we'll use lasers. So we'll see. By the time they get this thing working, we might have, hard drives that have.
Yeah.
I tried to find out what the far end of the spectrum was in terms of what's maybe possible in terms of information density. And I found something that was pretty cool. We're talking about electron quantum holography. You guys you're familiar with holograms. What they do is, and I've seen for years, I saw this years ago on some show. Basically, they take an image that they can store maybe on a crystal or some medium as a hologram. But what they do is they store the information in different wavelengths. So you have one wavelength of information, then you have another wavelength, and you're basically storing it right on top of the other wavelength, and they don't interact in any way. So you've got these discrete layers of data. They're talking about something like 3 exabytes per square inch. Now, an exabyte, you could fit 1 million terabytes in 1 exabyte. So that gives you an idea of what the potential density we might be seeing. Who knows how long this will take. But if they perfect this electron quantum holography, you're talking, wow, you can basically record your entire life in high definition using this technology type of thing.
That's pretty cool,
Bob. 80 years, yeah. So that's
something that. You know what's even cooler than that, though?
Watch.
Boob quake.
Oh, yeah. No argument for me.
Is that your segue?
Yeah, Rebecca, tell us about boobs.
Rebecca, what do you know about boobs?
Why me? It's not like mine are the biggest here. Come on.
Oh.
Whoa. Hey, my baloney tits are not bigger than your boobs.
Yeah, no, I could tell you about boobs. Well, it started with one particular boob, and that was a cleric in Iran who told his congregation that women dressing immodestly were causing all sorts of trouble, including adultery, and that that was causing earthquakes. Now, Iran is one of the most earthquake-prone countries in the world. I think something like 90% of the country is riddled with faults. So, you know, and I would venture,
tectonic,
I guess,
and
say that that the women there are not exactly leading the way in terms of immodesty.
Yeah, you would think like Las Vegas would have fallen into the sea by now if booze caused earthquakes.
If that were the measure, right.
Exactly. Yeah, they,
according to their own logic, they must be doing some really funky-ass stuff there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, who like, knows what's going on beneath the hijab.
Showing their wrists and their ankles. Ooh.
Yes, yeah. It's surely something so perverted that it puts Vegas to shame. But, yeah, so, you know, really, it goes without saying. His science doesn't exactly hold up. But a blogger, Jen McCrate of Blag Hag, came up with an idea to basically rebut this with, in pretty much the only way you can, which is by laughing at.
Yeah, she mocked it. She didn't really rebut it. There's not much to rebut. It's just,
yeah, right.
And it's just so absurd. So she responded with absurdity and suggested a boob quake, which is a pretty fantastic name, I have to admit. She was encouraging women to be as immodest as possible this past Monday in the hopes of, you know, creating a storm of earthquakes, to mix metaphors poorly. she was hoping to analyze the data afterwards and see whether or not many women coming together to dress immodestly would actually make a difference in the world's earthquakes. So this idea caught on pretty quickly, as you might guess that it would. And not only did it go from skeptic site to skeptic site, but it also got quite a bit of play on Facebook, and then the mainstream media picked up on it. So she was even mentioned on the Colbert Report,
awesome,
which is pretty high up on the list of cool things to happen to your cause. And she realized, I think, that what began as just a joke was sort of snowballing. So she did something really cool with it. She sold T-shirts, immodest T-shirts, I suppose. I'm not really sure. And
they looked like tank tops from the pictures that I saw.
Yeah. Slightly immodest. Not like assless chaps or anything.
Right.
But she sold some T-shirts, and the proceeds went to, I believe, the Red Cross, and half went to the JREF. And I think she tried to put it out there to any news organizations that were contacting her that, you know, the importance of critical thinking and examining claims like this. And so I think she did a really good job with the entire ordeal. And she got a lot of good attention to skeptical causes in a really fun way. So good job, Jen of Blag Hag.
So what happened on the day that women were supposed to show their cleavage and provoke the wrath of the earthquake?
I'm glad you asked. What happened was earthquakes. That's right, earthquakes happened. Now, except for that, you know, earthquakes happen every day.
Every day, right.
Literally every day.
There weren't, on average, there weren't any more or less?
There were not. If you go to Blag Hag, Jen has broken down the number of earthquakes that occurred and compared it to recent history of earthquakes, including, I think, last year's earthquakes, to see if they match up. And she's got all of her math and all of her statistics there. And it's really a fun way that you might learn about some interesting statistical facts.
Cool. Yeah, do you guys, Jay, how many magnitude 4 to 4.9 earthquakes do you think there were in 2009?
A few thousand.
6,928.
Wow.
Huh? 5 to 5.9, 1,754. 6 to 6.9, which is actually a serious earthquake, 142, so every few days. And then you get 16 in the 7s and only 1 in above 8.
The best statistic in the table of how many earthquakes have occurred. If you look for the year 2000, magnitude 4.0 to 4.9 earthquakes, there were 8,008
Yes.
And wow. Anyone who owns a calculator or owned a calculator when you were 9 years old might know that 8008 bears quite an importance to Boobquake.
Yes.
So. Right.
Coincidence?
Right. It can't be.
It not.
It absolutely cannot be a coincidence.
The cleric that prompted Boobquake, his story, or basically his sentiment, reminds me of recently that guy from the Vatican said that that all of the bad press about the church and the Pope recently is because of the devil. The devil's actually putting out right. the bad press.
Really?
Well, yeah, it's funny.
Play the devil card? There,
yes.
Oh. Yeah. I think that's a really good point, Jay, because I made a YouTube video mentioning Boobquake early on, and I had a number of people posting it, and you know, I assume that they're telling the truth when they say that they're from Iran, and they were a bit upset because they were saying, this is just one cleric, people are blowing this out of proportion, he's not actually important, nobody thinks he's, you know, nobody seriously yeah. believes this guy. And I thought that was very interesting because I think it shows the parallels between two cultures that we think are quite different. Because if you look at the States, one Pat Robertson, mere, what, like a year ago, 2 years ago? How often? He probably does it at least once a year. There's some natural disaster. And he blames
this year,
it.
I think he did it with the Haiti quakes, Haiti. I think.
Yeah.
Yes, you're right. The Haiti quake. I think he also, you know, New Orleans was blamed yep. on, you know, all of their sexual proclivities and whatnot, the gays. I think that you can directly compare this cleric yeah. to someone like Pat Robertson, where he'll say something idiotic, it'll get blown out of proportion, and it gets a lot of publicity. And you just want to say to other cultures, you
Please.
Know, this isn't somebody that we're listening to, we're laughing at him as well.
Yeah.
Well, the thing to remember, and a lot of people don't realize this because of all the press Iran gets, you know, you think people think of Ahmadinejad, if everyone they think of Iran or the mullahs. But in fact, of all the countries in the Mideast, all the Arab countries, the Iran actually probably has the most Western-educated, well-educated intellectuals. They, you know, the people themselves yeah. are probably a lot closer culturally to, you know, Westerners than a lot of other countries in that area.
They're just more greatly oppressed.
They're just under... Well, yeah. We focus on the rulers, but that really does not reflect the people at all.
Absolutely.
And I think you can see that in the aftermath to the recent elections, where
yes.
there was just a huge response, you know, from activists in the country.
Until they were beat down, literally beat down by the police, yeah.
Well, let's make a deal with the people of Iran. All right, we won't judge you on your wacko crazies. You just don't. I don't want to be put in the same group as Oral Roberts. How about that?
Right. Yeah. Maybe I think I'm going to have to do another YouTube video just about that.
Right.
Just
or Don McElroy or whatever. Yeah. But it is true that Americans get, you know, like Europeans think that, you know, judge Americans a lot by the people that they say in the media, which is like Don McElroy. You know, the Texas board of ed guy who doesn't believe in evolution and thinks that he needs to stand up to those experts.
I think Sarah Palin is
Sarah
the
Palin was another one out of my mouth. Yeah,
that's all I've been hearing about throughout the elections that are going on right now. They're like, well, but at least we don't have, you know, mm-hmm. science policy is pretty bad. but
just think about it, guys. I mean, there are people in other countries just like we do it all the time that are like, you know, hearing all this crazy news about Sarah Palin, and you know, she must have. I'm assuming that she has very, very bad press around the world.
I can say for sure that that's true here. So I mean, they definitely
imagine being thrown in. You know, she's an American, we're Americans. Thing like, God, please don't judge us on her, because I'm telling you right now,
don't judge us by any of our politics.
Well, I think there's also just the issue, the more generic issue of how the foreign press covers other countries.
Right.
One of our UK listeners wrote to me and was under the serious impression that under the current healthcare system in the United States, that if somebody went to an emergency room with a terminal acute illness, they essentially would be frisked for their insurance papers, and if they didn't have insurance, they would be left to die in the street.
Do you have your papers?
Yeah.
Which, of course, is absurd to any American. Like, that's ridiculous. People go to the emergency room to get their health care because you can't turn anybody away, right? That's where the uninsured go to get their health care. But
right. And then you just go bankrupt and die later.
Well, yeah. I mean, I said the problem is different. The problem is one of efficiency and finances, but people don't get turned away from the emergency room, you know. Right. But that was the way the foreign press was covering that issue.
Guys, talking about stereotypes, I'm looking at my quote file here, and I knew I had a funny quote. I forget where I got this, but this is a quote I got. And I think they were referring to Canadians, general Canadian attitude. I might be wrong about that, but this is the quote I have. It says that there's a stereotype of the dumb, fat American living in a trailer park waiting for the next tornado to come along. So
that's not imagine a whole country. Quote. That's just something everyone thinks.
Yeah, but Bob, that's a stereotype that I believe.
Well, it just kills me to think that people are out there thinking of the typical American, and that's the image that comes to mind.
Somebody from Eastern Europe, one of our listeners, I think, either on the message boards or emailed us, who said that the typical stereotype of an American in their country is a used car salesman in a cowboy hat.
Oh,
that's true. Actually.
That's awesome. That's a good one.
Sad.
Yippee-ki-yay, mofo.
All right, let's move on. Jay, tell us what Stephen Hawking's problem is with aliens.
He believes that alien life will most likely, not only does it most likely exist, but that our interaction with aliens would most likely not be a good idea. And he believes that because, he said, eventually when their technology gets advanced enough, you know, they're going to be resource hungry. And that hunger for resources is going to obviously drive them to move into other galaxies and move into other parts
galaxies?
Of the universe, other solar systems, obviously at first, and then you know as it gets more and more advanced. And he speculates about this was really cool. He speculates about these gigantic ships come up near a star, and then all these littler ships come out, and then those little ships literally surround the sun, and they open themselves up, and they collect all of the energy radiating from the sun. They focus it into this machine. That machine creates a wormhole, and then they just move. You know that enables them to move great distances. You know, like the classic sci-fi wormhole. And then you see them appear right in front of the Earth. You know, which is of course the worst case scenario. But you know, he did say though that there is a danger there. I went around the blogosphere and I wanted to see what other people were saying. And my first stop was at Phil Plates, the bad astronomer. And Phil, what's up, brother? Phil doesn't agree with Hawking.
Yeah, I don't either.
He thinks that, and I'll give a quick quote from Phil's blog. He says, it's more likely that an aggressive alien race would create self-replicating robot probes that will disperse through the galaxy and destroy all life that way. And I agree with Phil in regards to them just not traveling themselves and just sending robot probes out.
Yeah, bring the resources back to you.
Phil also doesn't think that the universe is overrun with life and that we're most likely among the first, which I thought was interesting. And then I jumped over to PZ Meyer's Ferengula blog, and PZ came out swinging. He's basically like, "Look,
oh yeah,
yeah." He goes, Listen, it's going to be interplanetary biowarfare, right? And and PZ goes, if it was up to me, what we would do if we were the advanced alien race, which in somebody's perspective we are. He goes, we should be sending out machines that are going to go to other worlds that are going to seed those worlds with fungus and bacteria and start the ecosystem, get it to the point where there's an actual biosphere there. Then he goes, and then right at the
terraforming.
At the perfect timing, he goes, we're going to send big spaceships out that have embryos in them. And of course, I'm thinking of Bob. And those embryos are going to come to maturity, and then they're going to go and seed the planets. And he's like, we should be proliferating our biology all over the universe. He goes, because that's going to keep us in survival mode.
The problem with that, though, is that by the time you get there, there's lots of problems with it, I think. But the one problem is that by the time you get there, who knows what those bacteria would have evolved into? Maybe they could have evolved into some nasty critters that you don't want to coexist with. Wait, no. If you're talking about bacteria colonizing a planet,
I mean, you mean after the colonization?
Right. After that, plus, and then sending the ships, I think, is a big problem. You know, unless you're talking about using something like wormholes that really don't seem to be supported very well.
No, Bob.
Physics. But no, Jay, listen, you're talking about going there and getting resources, but the resources you're going to spend to get the ship to this planet are going to blow away any resources you're going to potentially get from the planet.
No, that's not what PZ is saying. PZ is just saying, just out. Send it out. Just let it go. Put our biology out there. Let it do whatever it does, but let's fill up.
Yeah.
Let's fill up.
Well, it's an interesting point. I mean, he thinks that rather than sending out robots to colonize or terraform or destroy or gather resources or whatever, that other advanced races will just engage in bio-warfare. They'll just send out biology and colonize the galaxy and the universe that way. And therefore, if we want, we have to do it just to compete. We should be working on doing that. Now, of course, it's going to be a long-term plan. You know, it's going to take tens of thousands of years or whatever to really make some significant progress. But if for long-term survival, we have to compete. We have to do it.
That kind of sucks, though, because why impose our own biology? I'd like to go and study other biology, not with the shit that already evolved on our planet.
Stay on target, man. We're talking about taking over the universe, right? We're not talking about that, right? That's a different topic. Rebecca, what do you think?
Which way are we going to die? Who cares?
No, we're talking about survival. We're talking about not dying. We have to beat the aliens at their own game. We cannot afford to have a bio-warfare gap.
I really appreciate that in this intergalactic game of chess, you're all thinking 5 million light years ahead.
Yeah,
of course.
Wait, yes.
5
you million must.
Years ahead. But no.
Rebecca, I will have you know right now, an alien planet, there's a bunch of aliens recording a podcast and they're talking about killing you.
Me, personally.
Right? So we've got to prepare.
I had this discussion with my friend Izzy the other day, actually last night, where we assume that Stephen Hawking actually is just really paranoid about aliens that hate Stephen Hawking, that they're just going to focus in on him because mm-hmm. he knows something. So I think that's what this is all about.
He knows
self-protection.
Yeah.
Well, he did. Didn't he send his DNA into outer space?
What?
Yeah, I think he did.
Like he jerked off into a cup or
like
something?
He threw it up in the air.
Oh, my God. Like, no.
He's like, I'm terraforming this bitch.
How about panspermia?
Oh.
Anywho. So, Evan, I understand that they've discovered, finally discovered Noah's Ark.
Finally. After all these years. After 4,800.
Where was it hiding?
Apparently on Mount Ararat.
Wasn't it always there?
Yes, but it's been buried and hidden and out of sight.
It's
for
only
so
one
long.
Mountain, for God's sakes. But I think they would have found it.
But a group of Chinese and Turkish evangelical explorers say the wooden remains that they discovered on the mountain in eastern Turkey are the remains of Noah's Ark. Yes. Now, they're not 100% sure. They're only 99% sure, according to
them. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Big difference.
Well, they're scientists, yes. So they got to leave some room for reasonable doubt, right?
And there's a pretty picture right there, and it's part of this article, and there's one of the evangelical explorers. You know, in the background is some wood planks, kind of old, and it could be anything. It could be the corner of a building, or it could be an ark, you know? I mean,
Why do they think that it's an ark?
They believe it is because there are relics, and the carbon dating proves of the relic. The carbon dating of the relics found at the site are 4,800 years old, roughly. They date around to the same time that the Ark was said to be afloat, and this has long been suspected as the final resting place of the Ark. So that's all. That's it.
I like that they suddenly decided that carbon dating was cool.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that if you checked, these are the same people who believe that carbon dating was a tool of the devil and not to be trusted.
But not when it comes to validating biblical claims, Rebecca.
Yeah,
not
when it gives
the
answer you want. You know, when it gives an answer you don't want, like with the Shroud of Turin, then it's evil.
That's a good point. Well, I think the really interesting thing about this story, though, is that other evangelical Christians are crying that it's a fake. Did you see this?
Yeah, Randall Price, who is also an Ark hunter and young Earth creationist, says he was there on the expedition and the whole thing was a hoax.
Ah.
He has the photos to prove it, and that essentially what's going on is that there's a local industry now taking money from foreign Noah's Ark hunters, charging them lots of money to lead them around Mount Ararat, and that they're supporting this industry by maybe seeding a few locations with some wood, because that's what the people are looking for, right?
Yep. I really like, though, I think that this is a wonderful story because, I mean, first of all, it gives most of us something to chuckle about. But more importantly is that young Earth creationists are suddenly discovering the scientific method. Yeah. I think that now you're going to have a large group of creationists who really want to believe that this story is true, but now another of their group is saying that it's not true, and now they're going to have no choice but to look at the evidence and decide whether or not it's true. So I think that this is an excellent, this is like a little entry-level science experiment for them.
Yeah, it's always fun when you get dueling pseudosciences, right? Because then people will readily, it's interesting, they'll readily start debunking and engaging their skepticism about the other pseudoscience, just not their own. It's selective.
Yeah.
But I do think there's some value in at least doing it. And maybe at some point the light will go on or somebody will point out to them that you need to apply that same methodology to the stuff you want to believe too, not just the stuff you don't want to believe. Right.
Yeah, I think it's a gateway skepticism.
Well, Evan, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
2 weeks ago was our last Who's That Noisy, so let's listen to it again. So that noise is actually solar wind rubbing up against the Earth's magnetic field and being recorded. And congratulations to Trinoc from the message boards who guessed correctly. First one to guess correctly. Well done. And may I also pass along a thank you to Carrie Hassan for sending along that noisy. So thank you, Carrie.
Yeah, that was a good one. Thanks, Evan. What do you got for this week?
Okay, on to this week's Who's That Noisy. See if you can tell who this screaming person is.
If you say there's no God, if you're an atheist, you're saying the flowers, the birds, the trees, the sun, the moon, the stars, everything happened by accident.
There you go. So figure out who's screaming Who's That Noisy this week. Give it your best guess. Good luck, everyone.
Thank you, Evan. Well, I think we have time for one question. This one comes from Anton Lance from Sweden, and he writes, my name is Anton Lance. I'm 22 years old and hard at work on my master's degree in media technology here in Sweden. I've been a skeptic before I was even aware of the term. I have a measured IQ of 140. God, what a moron. And have a question regarding intelligence later in the post. My second question relates to intelligence and the scientific method. What I really want your opinion on is the apparent lack of understanding for and no actual comprehension of the importance of the scientific method. How do proponents of the unscientific method expect society to look like when logical thinking and good science takes a backseat to flim-flam and guess science? And do you think that logical thinking or lack thereof is solely a question of upbringing and teaching at a young age? Has intelligence anything to do with it at all?
I would like to commend Anton on starting a new custom and really outlining the way it should be when you send an email to the SGU. It should be name, age, IQ.
IQ, right.
Yes.
In that order.
Because that way we can just skim through them and, you know.
it's an easier problem.
Which ones are worth our time. I'm sorry. And also if you could say which test it was that you took.
Yeah, which standardized test. Yeah, we need to know these things. But speaking of intelligence, so I guess he's asking, first of all, what's the relationship between just global intelligence and logic, critical thinking, and appreciation for the scientific method? That's tricky because intelligence is multifactorial. There isn't just one kind of intelligence. It's many things. It's memory and creativity and insight, as well as mathematical calculation, appreciation for music.
Raw knowledge.
Yeah, just so there's lots of different components, and they are while there is a lot of interaction among those, and there are some intellectual abilities that are more generic than others, the ability to really focus your attention, for example, will hold you well no matter what you're doing. There are also independent variables. I mean, you could be really good at one thing and terrible at another thing. So it's hard to talk about quote-unquote intelligence as if it were one thing. But having said that massive caveat, I think that having the appropriate kind of smarts certainly makes it easier to understand logic and the scientific method. But the rest, I think, is upbringing and exposure. You know, I think if you're not taught anything about science to have an appreciation for it or critical thinking, logical thinking, it's not something that's intuitive or inherent. You could be, I think, a very intelligent person that doesn't have any appreciation for logic or critical thinking. I think I know some people like that who I think are very bright, but just don't understand how to think logically or critically.
Yeah, right? I think you can, you know, if you look at, I mean, Mensa, I think, is a good example. That's a club for people who are, who score well on certain tests and, you know, so on certain IQ tests. And, you know, there's plenty of people in Mensa who subscribe to conspiracy theories and UFOs and, you know, ideas about the paranormal.
Yep.
It's not the same thing. Being able to pass a test does not relate to being able to think critically, because you can't – it's much more difficult, at least, to create a standardized test that tests your ability to examine claims, to examine evidence, and come to – you know, a conclusion independent of your belief system.
Yeah. Well, let's go on with our interview. Joining us now is Dr. Dean Adell. Dr. Adell, welcome back to the Skeptic's Guide.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And Dr. Adell is America's physician. He is a syndicated radio talk show host. You've been on the air over 30 years now, is that right?
No, we're not going there.
quite a while. You have several million regular listeners, up to 6 million, I understand, at times. And you are syndicated in over 90 markets. So quite a successful talk radio career.
Yeah, we're actually closer to 200, 300 markets.
Oh, is that right? My information is all.
In radio, just a minor deal.
Not awesome. Yeah, right.
And as rare as your success is, it's also rare in my experience to have someone with a regular talk show with such a wide audience who is so dedicated unapologetically to science. Honestly, you know, whenever I catch your show, one time I just flipped through the channels. I wasn't aware it was even you. And there's some guy talking about homeopathy, and it really hard hit him. I'm like, this guy is awesome. He's saying everything that I would say, and of course it was you.
Oh, that's great.
And that was quite a compliment if you don't realize it.
Well, ditto to you guys. You know, it's sad that it's so rare, isn't it?
Yes.
Why can there not be shows that can entertain and hold an audience at the same time be factually based? I still don't get that part of it, but nevertheless, it's what it is.
Yeah, it's just, I mean, it is hard to understand sometimes. I mean, I understand the social forces at work and everything, but still, it always shocks me. We're in the position now, somehow the world got flipped upside down, where we're in the position where we have to defend the very notion that medicine should be based upon good science. It's crazy to me.
Quite remarkable, and maybe we're getting ahead of ourselves, but you think this period of time we just went through where people have a distrust of vaccines, one of the greatest public health accomplishments of all time, and yet they trust, okay, and just start your list of all these bogus, sleazy supplement companies, they trust that,
right.
but not a vaccine. And if that isn't an upside-down world, then I don't know what is.
Yeah, it's really a marketing coup. I mean, a lot of the proponents of these dubious methods, I think some of them are true believers, but some are just, they're just hawking snake oil, really. And yep. They've managed to tell people, essentially, don't believe your physician because he's influenced by the pharmaceutical industry who's just trying to sell you something. Rather, believe my miracle claim so that I can sell you something. and people buy it.
You know, I can't think of a more unattached physician than myself. I mean, I haven't practiced since 1972, and there was a big period of time in between. I don't belong to the AMA. I'm not beholden to any pharmco or hospital or any organization.
Or so you say.
I have that same battle. And you said something there. I don't want to let it slide by because I think it's really very, very poignant. It is marketing. There's nobody marketing, you know, say, vaccines. We just assumed that people, you know, would kind of get it. There's nobody marketing, you know, scientific anything. We just assumed that science doesn't need marketing and all the snake oil needs the marketing. But listen, we are, as a country, brilliant marketers. We have the best marketers in the world. We can sell people anything if we want to, and they'll buy it. And I think that's part of the issue.
Yeah, and I agree. And with, I think, like, the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, is belatedly trying to market vaccines, but they're not very good at it. And it also seems to backfire in that it makes it seem like there's something sleazy about the vaccines if someone's got to be selling it to the public. You know what I mean? Like, it should either it speaks for itself or there's something wrong with it.
Yeah, you're caught in a tough spot. You're being a rock in a hard place. You know, if they try to sell it, you go, why are they trying to sell us this versus the fact that they haven't sold it well? Or maybe they never needed to. It was just the forces of evil that conspire against us are doing a better job. I don't know. I just, it perplexes me. It's one question I just have trouble answering. Yes, there are multiple reasons. I got an email from a listener recently who said, you know, the reason is that as Americans, the founding of this country was built on distrust of power and distrust of authority and distrust of all the, you know, the regal forces in Europe at the time and religion, etc., and that we have this innate skepticism of government, of scientists, etc. Yeah, oh, well, and fine, but where is this innate skepticism of industry in this case? And it's totally and completely unregulated industry. So that doesn't fit to me either. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, they've pulled off a great bait and switch. And I often point out to people, I think they feel good about buying vitamins or supplements, which they think is coming from like some mom and pop, you know, patent medicine producer, but it's, you know what, Big Pharma owns the supplement industry basically now. It's the same companies selling these things.
Just like organic foods, you know, all owned by major agribusiness companies, but people think it's a, you know, little guy with a plow and an oxen, you know, tilling the earth with, you know, bountiful fruits and vegetables.
That's right.
Again, it's almost marketing again, isn't it? Yeah.
Right, right. Do you encounter the anti-vaccinationists, if you will, frequently? Do you get a lot of feedback from them on your show?
Feedback, that's a polite word. They want to kill me, string me up. And that's another thing, the vehemence, the violence, you know, it's like what's happened to politics today, you know, where anger seems to be the first response. I'm used to people responding emotionally to a lot of objective issues, but this has gotten out of hand. And it's funny, the litany of things that people have said to me. And we've gone through a particularly difficult period with vaccines, you know, with the flu vaccine, et cetera. You can tell people straight out the origin of their disbeliefs and the sources of these things and say, look, this was an urban rumor. This was an email that was made up by somebody. They were kidding around. They were playing a joke on you. And still they don't believe the obvious. And the anger has really kind of thrown me, but the accusations are the same. I'm tied in with a pharmaceutical company. I make money from it. You know, I guarantee you I don't make money from vaccines. And it is quite something. I don't know what this means in terms of, I feel it's reflecting something in our culture that it's hard to put our finger on, but I'm not particularly sure exactly what it is.
I think it's possible that it's general distrust for large corporations and large governments. I mean, we've, you know, over the years, I mean, I'm 41 years old and I still consider myself young, but even in my lifetime, you know, I feel like I've been kind of burned by my government and by local government. You know, I have to admit that I have a general knee-jerk reaction to distrust what I'm told. I mean, how many times do we have to go through situations where we catch people lying or you know, confabulating things or misrepresenting? I mean, it does happen. And I think, you know, back in the 40s and 50s, the government was very much respected.
Yes. I think we have to go where you're pointing, because I think there is something there. Now, I'm an old-time hippie. And we distrusted everything. And I remember those feelings, government, industry, et cetera. You know, you got to pick and choose. In other words, if you don't trust government, you don't trust industry, you don't trust, you know, religion, you know, you realize that it's healthy to be skeptical, you should pardon the expression. It's just when individuals start to sort it all out, I think it becomes confusing, because I remember back then being kind of holistic and alternative, you know. I remember kind of wanting to see authority overthrown. It was romantic. It was exciting to think you're participating in that. And I think a lot of people, because they've lost touch with understanding the science behind things, because science hasn't done a great marketing job either. People just want the goodies. I mean, it's strange. They want the computers, the TVs, the airplanes, everything. They love it. They love it. They love it. They don't understand all of that came from science, and they don't trust that. I mean, they have great trust for it, although my computer I want to kill half the time. Basically, you know, I trust the process. And yeah, I know there's crooked people out there, and there are liars, and there are conspiracies occasionally. But I guess that the trick is, you know, separating out the baby from the bathwater. And a lot of people don't know how to discriminate, and so the distrust is a blanket distrust, other than the things that almost, you know, subconsciously they pick and choose to trust. I like to use airline metaphors, you know. I say, would you get on a plane that, you know, you want that plane to be tested and retested and as carefully gone over as possible, but yet when it comes to, you know, buying a bottle of pills and sticking it in your face, you have no discrimination whatsoever. It's the same process. Why do you, you know, insist on technology to support your participation in air travel, but not in other things? And you come up with all kind of heinous intention of the people behind it all. So, yes, I think you're right. I think you've definitely touched on it. It has to be that. I mean, that's really the only explanation, but it really comes back to why and how do people decide what they trust and what they don't trust.
Yeah. I think along those lines, too, reinforcing it is people are generally uncomfortable with the gray, right? They want it to be black or white, whereas, as you say, yeah, you just distrust government, but you trust certain things once you think it makes sense or you verified it. Yeah, there's fraud in science, but that doesn't mean you distrust all of science. It means you have to you pick through it and try to decide what's credible and what's not credible. But that's hard work, and it's a process. I guess it's easier just to believe what you want to believe and then dismiss whatever is inconvenient.
Yes, well, you hit the nail again on the head. And you guys must talk about this a lot, because you have these really great, you know, condensed thoughts. You know, that black and white thing I think is really powerful and important. And I, you know, the first time I ever crossed this was, you know, at a time of my life going through a relationship problem and deciding, you know, going to talk to a counselor. And the very, very first thing that he pointed out was how as human beings in our emotional lives and our daily lives, we do love things to be black and white. We love it when it's good and evil. And we want crisp, clean, and clear feelings about things, and that is not what life offers. And I think in the grander scale, you're absolutely right on that people want the simplest answers. And, you know, vaccines are evil. Man, that's easy. I can understand that one.
Yeah.
You know, or something absolutely, you know, perfect and good. I mean, they'll believe a washed-up grade B movie actress more than they will their pediatrician. It's bizarre, but the grade B actress is offering a very simple, straightforward perspective that is black and white, and that's easy to grasp.
Yeah, it is a Hollywood kind of approach. And then if you do think that vaccines are evil, then everything sort of flows from that. Well, then anyone who's defending vaccines must be evil too, or on the take or whatever. And that's why they'll just assume, well, you must be on the payroll of Big Pharma because you're defending vaccines.
Absolutely. That's what happens. And we label. And I suppose, listen, we do the same thing. You know, I guess in a way when, you know, I see the people who are believed, you know, some of these anti-vaccinationist doctors even, you know, you can tell immediately. I can go to a website and just a few couple of key phrases, and you know, oh, brother, look what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose, you know, I do the same thing, but I feel kind of secure in my evaluation, and I just see when people suspend reality in trying to take care of patients, you know, I start to wonder, gee, they went to medical school also. How did they get to be so stupid? What's going on? Well, right. You know, they have the various motivations also, and, you know, some are just misguided and weren't well-educated, and they really believe in what they're doing. You know, I kind of give them a half a break versus those who just absolutely know, you know, that they're ripping people off and do it willingly.
Yeah.
You know, there's another group of apologists when I, you know, I get them in a corner of a cocktail party and I nail their asses, you know, they'll say, well, listen, you know, better me than somebody who has no training. I'm a doctor. There's no insurance companies. People want this. They pay cash. And at least I know they have a disease process that isn't going to get out of hand. So I'm giving them what they want. And listen, isn't it better to offend them for this and that as opposed to just giving them Oxycontin for their pain? And so there becomes almost this therapeutic justification, which sounds, you know, sounds tenable. Until you think it through, and you say, well, wait a second, so what you're doing is selling people, you know, placebos, but because you're a doctor, you think you can get away with it. And, you know, you get into all kinds of ethical conundrums, but it's funny, and I suppose I make my judgments also, but I like to think mine are more correct.
Right.
Well, you have science and evidence to back you up on it.
Yes, absolutely. That is so critical. Let me hit on that again, in that, you know, I find myself saying this more and more on radio these days. I say, listen, don't shoot the messenger. I'm just here transmitting to you scientific articles and tidbits of research that are happening out there in the world. If you got an argument with it, don't talk to me. You know, talk to the people who, you know, who are doing the research. And that's all it is. That's all it's about.
Right. Yeah, I think that's half the battle, is just getting people not to make it personal. You know, I find myself saying the same thing all the time. I'm just synthesizing the research.
Right.
Just telling you what the research shows. That's my job. Speaking of the purveyors of dubious modalities, we were talking before we started recording about a news item recently on Gary Null. Now, I know you're familiar with who Gary Null is.
Oh, I'm familiar. I got in a beef with him once, and we had to do lawyers to unsettle it. And I wanted me to do a retraction of something I said, which I could have said, and that was legal. And I realized the retraction they wanted me to read on the air made him look more foolish than the original thing that I said about him, because it's precarious these days. Yes, I love this story. Schadenfreude, what can I tell you? It's remarkable that he would, you know, he evidently got sick on one of his own products, and it was a question of vitamin A toxicity involved.
Vitamin D,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
and of course, his symptoms, you know, fit exactly vitamin D toxicity. I don't know what really happened. Maybe he just got food poisoning from something else. But, you know, you take too much vitamin D and you can get nausea and vomiting and weakness, and you can lose weight, and, you know, you can get all kinds of mental changes and serious stuff. And I think this is really, really a terrific story. I'm sorry for giggling, but, you know, people think the guy is a guru and, you know, and knows all these things that they don't know, and then he sells all this stuff to people. His red stuff powder, and he didn't drink his hair cleaner, but he says he suffered kidney damage and left bloodied in intense pain from two daily servings of a supplement that he makes. It's Ultimate Power Meal, which evidently is overloaded with vitamin D. I have no idea how much vitamin D is in here. There's a lot of confusion right now about vitamin D and what's a toxic amount, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, what can I tell you? Hey, maybe there really is a God. What do you guys think?
Dr. Dean, wasn't he actually taking his own supplement that he was selling?
Yes, exactly. It says here that he was using his own product, and he's blaming it on the manufacturer of his particular, you know, brand of supplements, and so he filed suit against them, you know, we'll see. Well, see, either way, it's a funny little line. Not, you think this will make a difference? You think sales of his products will go down? Of course not.
No.
Right. Oh, his followers, I will brush this off. But, you know, I do think it may have an effect if people do, I think, simplistically associate. Oh, yeah, Null, wasn't that the guy who got sick on his own product? I think the people who aren't familiar with him already, you know, it may adversely affect his reputation. But you're right, it won't really affect the market. But what I'm reading is that I think the New York Times reported that Null claims the manufacturer put in 1,000 times the dose of vitamin D that was supposed to be in there.
Just 1,000-fold?
Wow. 1,000 times. That's oops. Well,
maybe the manufacturer thought it was homeopathic or something.
He went the opposite direction, right?
If it's true that they did put 1,000 times more product in there, you know, it increased the dosage by 1,000 times. First of all, like, where is this being manufactured where they can make such an incredible error like that? Number one. And number two, sadly, I'm not even sure that I believe him when he says that. I think that he did legitimately get sick on his product. I think his product was actually unhealthy, hands down.
Yes, I agree. I mean, it's hard to know what the truth is in this. Did you say there's a New York Times version of this story? Because the one copy I have is the Daily News, which is hardly the...
It's actually a New York Post article.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're right, Evan. It's New York Post. It was not New York Times.
It was
New York
Post. Okay. So, yeah. I don't know. It's, Triarco Industries. Now, you know, maybe they're in China. Who knows? Maybe he's got melamine in his products.
It's, right.
It's kind of interesting, but it'll be it'll be interesting. It's been pulled. It's the ultimate power meal. It's evidently been pulled from store shelves. And, well, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of fallout from this. We'll see it over at Quack Watch and Consumer Digest and, you know, everybody will have a field day with it.
Yeah.
I'm like you. I don't know exactly what's going on. The story is too incomplete, you know.
Yeah, so we're going to have to track it. We certainly can't take his word for what's going on.
Right.
But, I mean, even no matter how you slice it, it's a very interesting story because Gary Null is one of these healthcare gurus who has called regular physicians, you know, guilty of medical genocide, and, you know, he really, you know, pumps up the rhetoric against mainstream medicine. Talk about conspiracy theories. Yep. And he recommends mega doses of vitamins, I mean, ridiculously high doses. And just the fact that he's now suffering from vitamin toxicity, regardless of whose fault it is, you know, contradicts a lot of his own rhetoric, no matter how you slice it.
Yep, exactly, exactly. The only question is, will other people see it the same way?
I definitely put people like Gary Null up there with Kevin Trudeau, who I think is probably the worst.
Isn't he something? They keep putting him in jail and fining him millions of dollars, and he kept popping back and, you know, flaunting it. And he's amazing. He's amazing.
Right.
He's an unsinkable rubber duck.
Yep. The unsinkable rubber duck. And you know, if the guy went straight, he'd probably be brilliant. Probably he would be as wealthy as he is. And yet the things he says are so illogical and why people would believe a person that just has a long history of fraud going back before he got into health. And, you know, health is an easy place to rip people off. You know, it's there's a wonderful movie. I'm sure maybe you've all seen it. If not, I recommend it, called The Road to Wellville.
Yes.
It's about Kellogg, and in there is a great statement. It says, "Health, the open sesame of the sucker's wallet."
Oh, God, that's perfect.
With health, we suspend our belief. You know, if I give you a pill and said, put it in your gas tank, you'll get 100 miles at a gallon, I'd be laughed out of town. But if I said, here's a pill, eat the pill, and you'll live to be 100, people would say, oh, that's cool, I think I'll try it.
Yeah, is it just that the allure is too irresistible? Is that what it comes down to, you think?
That's a big part of it.
It's got to be.
It's got to be that. It's got to be wishful thinking. It's got to, you know, we just think, well, what do we have to lose? You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Money back guarantee. If you call me in 92 years and you only live that long, you know, you come back and collect it. I tell you, here's a general concept. I know you know this, but it bears repeating because I've had to learn it the hard way. We love stories.
Mm-hmm.
The example that now is Hackney, but, you know, you're going to buy a car and you go to Consumer Reports and get all the data, and then you go to work and someone says, hey, my mother-in-law has that car, it's a lemon. You'll believe that person way more than all the data. Bars and graphs and information is no match for stories, for human stories. And I think that's why when you see a television show and, you know, Jenny McCarthy goes on Oprah and says, oh, my poor son has autism, that mm-hmm. will stay in a consumer's mind forever. Whereas, you know, all of our exhortations and warnings and graphs and charts and data and science, you know, doesn't have that kind of an impact. So I've kind of started trying to come up with stories to match the scientific truth. And when I talk about vaccines, for instance, you know, I get someone to call up and describe that her child got whooping cough, and then she describes what it's like watching that child, you know, almost cough themselves to death. That has impact. And,
yeah.
and the mail I get and the feedback I get after that, you know, has meaning. So I try to keep that in mind, you know, when I'm just spewing data and science in terms of getting people to understand, you know, logically and at an emotional level what this is about.
Right. Well, Dr. Dean Adell, thank you so much for fighting the good fight as long as you have. We are definitely happy to have you out there.
No, please. My pleasure, but it's frustrating. I'm sure you come across it also. I read all your stuff and check all your, and I see the fight you're fighting too. And it's, like it's a breath of fresh air to see other people out there doing it, but I'm afraid we are small voices, and I don't quite get that. I set out doing what I do in commercial radio and television. I wanted that. I didn't want to go to public radio or television. I didn't want to talk to the converted. I want to tackle the front lines. And I'm afraid it feels like it's, you know, hasn't accomplished very much. Although, listen, there is a fan base for all of us, and there are people out there who get it, and I hope they'll always be there, and that's, you know, that's where the movement can spread, and people can, I think, begin to understand it from friends and family, and hopefully the truth will win.
Well, Dr. Dean Adell, thank you again for joining us.
My pleasure. I loved it.
Thanks, Dr. Dean.
Thanks, Dr. Dean.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of expert skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Now, we have an interesting science fiction this week in that there are three simultaneous independent themes to this science or fiction.
Technically, that means there's no theme.
We'll see. No, not one for each item. There's three different themes running through all three items, and we'll see if you guys can figure out what they are. Okay, here we go. Item number one. Japanese scientists have genetically engineered a hairless rat with genes from an octopus, allowing the rat to rapidly change its skin color with changes in mood and environment.
Awesome.
Item number two, Australian researchers report that they have developed a new vaccine delivery system, a nanopatch, that in animal studies uses 100 times less vaccine than current methods with the same immune response. And item number three, Belgium scientists report that they have documented herding behavior in earthworms. Rebecca, please go first.
No. Well, yeah, we're thinking that I think the themes there's animals in all of them, and there's foreign countries in all of them.
That's two of them. The third one, you just have to guess. There's no way to infer them from the actual items. Mm. So let's just think about that, and why don't you give us
your
answer.
I'll go from the bottom up. I think herding behavior in earthworms, I can believe that. I can see worm cowboys rustling up worms on the prairie.
Oh my God.
There are little hats involved. So yeah, that makes sense for some reason to me. So I think that's science. A nanopatch that uses 100 times less vaccine. That would be huge because one of the main problems with things like the flu vaccine is figuring out a way to manufacture a large number of them. So that would be a very useful thing for, say, a drug company or something to research and find. I think that's probably true as well. So that brings us to a hairless rat with genes from an octopus that allow the rat to rapidly change its skin color with changes in mood and environment. First of all, I just have to ask why. Why would we do that? I'm just picturing this poor hairless rat sitting on the table, rapidly changing colors, and it makes me sad. So while I think that there have been studies that have done similar things like that, there's kittens that they had glowing in the dark and things, using genes from phosphorescent or bioluminescent animals. But that's a bit more basic. This would be hardcore. There's a lot going on there. I feel like that would take a bit more effort, and I don't think that they're there yet. And also, the Japanese are well known for their ability to make anything adorable, and there's no way that a hairless rat changing colors with octopus genes is cute. So that is fiction.
Okay.
That's my final answer.
Jay?
The Japanese scientist that messed with the rat that gave it genes of an octopus – I agree with Rebecca. I think that sounds really crazy. Like, you know, and I'm of course visualizing, like, you know, profound color changes. It could be very subtle. It could be, you know, maybe certain parts of the skin or whatever. But as it's written, it doesn't seem plausible to me. Australian researchers report they've developed a new vaccine delivery nano patch. I don't know. This one's screaming fake as well. I just don't. You know, I'm kind of. You know, the nano patch, like, what, how small is this thing? Can't even see it? You put it on? What's going on with that? Is that what you're saying? It's a really small patch?
That would be what nano implies.
Steve?
Yeah, it's small.
Wow, you suck.
That was curt.
But, you know, if you take nano patch out of it and you just think of a vaccine delivery system that's a patch, then that's delivering the vaccine to you, and maybe there's something about giving a small amount over time. That makes sense. I think that is definitely possible. And then we have the last one, the earthworm, the cowboy earthworms with the hats.
It's appealing, isn't it?
You know, I don't know why. I agree with Rebecca. There's something about this that I believe. Yeah, okay, I bet you that there's some, they communicate through vibration or something, and that, yeah, they maybe they do move together. Sure, that one doesn't seem that crazy. Yeah, I just don't think the rat with the joystick changing color thing is real.
Okay.
I added the joystick in because that's how I figure they'd make it change color.
All that's right. Fake. Evan?
The Japanese scientist engineering the hairless rat with the genes of an octopus. That is a tough one to swallow, given the three choices, I think. The rat to rapidly change its skin color as it changes mood and environment. I don't know. Isn't it more than just a genetic mechanism that allows that to happen? I think there has to be more going on than simply just a change in the genetics there. I'm inclined to say that one's fiction, which means the other two are fact, so I don't even have to talk about those.
Okay, Bob.
The herding behavior for earthworms. I remember seeing a show where this guy actually but he actually put a rod in the ground and banged it. And basically he had worms coming up all around him. Now, I don't know if you would call that herding, but I'm going to go with that and say that is what it was. And let's see, the new delivery system, the nano patch. I'm not sure how tiny they're talking there, but that, you know, I could see that. That'd be great. I guess I could kind of go with that. Nothing's really leaping out at me for that one. So I'm going to tentatively say that one is science. The first one here, I agree with everybody else. I think the octopus is a mimic octopus that can change its color at the speed of thought. It's not like a chameleon that's where it's a chemical change. It's really fast as hell. It's amazing to watch what these things can do. The thing is, though, that I think they've got specialized skin cells, but there's also some kind of funky connection to these cells to the brain, I think, in such a way that you could have such a rapid impact on the skin just by what you're currently thinking or what your environment is. So I think that would be quite an extensive change that genetic engineering isn't quite up to yet. I mean, they'll probably get there eventually, but I don't think we're quite there yet. So for that reason, I'm going to say that one is fiction.
Okay, so you all went with number one, so I'll take these in reverse order. So with number three, Belgium scientists report that they have documented herding behavior in earthworms. You guys all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Yay.
And Bob, it's what you described, you know, all the like worms coming up to the surface in response to ringing a rod or something. It was not hurting. That they would just all be independently responding to the same stimuli. With herding, that implies they're responding to each other, right? Like a herd of animals, they're all traveling together because they're all responding to each other.
Yeah,
so,
makes sense.
Yeah, so what they found was that earthworms actually do have some mechanism of communication and that they actually can herd. They can actually sort of move in the same direction, you know, only based upon what the other worms are doing. They can travel in a single herd. Very cool. Let's go on to number two. Australian researchers report that they have developed a new vaccine delivery system, a nanopatch, that in animal studies uses 100 times less vaccine than current methods with the same immune response. And that one is also science.
Yay!
Good job, everyone.
Nice.
Yay.
Yes, we knew it.
Yeah, these things are very tiny. They're like much smaller than a postage stamp. They show a picture of one being picked up with a little pair of tweezers. And they have little pores in them, like these little prongs. So you just put it on your skin, and these little invisible projections, they're you know just too small to be seen, you know, penetrate the skin, and they present the antigen, the vaccine, to the immune system. And in animal studies that they've done so far, they say that with only 100th the dose of the antigen, they're producing an equivalent immune response to an actual intramuscular or subcutaneous injection.
Wow.
So, and Rebecca, you're right. This would be there's huge advantages here. One, of course, is that like with the flu vaccine, you know, imagine if we could make the virus that has to be grown very quickly go 100 times as far. You know, we instead of making only 100 million doses, we could make 10 billion. Right, that'd be more than we would need. So yeah, so that would solve that problem. They also talked about the fact that because it doesn't require an injection, it'd be a lot cheaper. You know, to actually do this. Than to produce the vials and the syringes, et cetera. But also imagine a flu vaccine campaign where you just mail people the patch and you take it out of the envelope and stick it on their skin. You know, so it would be easy to distribute. Mm. A lot easier to store. A lot easier to distribute. So,
but it's cool that they can make it that small and stuff. But maybe they're going to do what I'm going to suggest. But I think that sounds too small to me. Why not just make it as big as a regular size Band-Aid so that you can keep track of the damn thing? So you're like, hey, where did I put that? I don't see it. Oh, there it is.
They might embed it in something.
Yeah.
They
probably would.
So it's not too
That's how
tiny,
I feel about chihuahuas.
Right.
Chihuahua.
You need to put them in like a little, embed them in a robotic extender so that they're bigger. Which means Japanese scientists have genetically engineered a hairless rat with genes from an octopus. Allowing the rat to rapidly change its skin color with changes in mood and environment is totally fiction. So you guys buy the glow-in-the-dark kittens, but not the the hairless mood rats.
Well, right. First of all, they're cuter. And second of all, it's easier. Yeah, makes perfect sense.
All right, so you want to know what the third theme was?
Yeah.
These were all submitted by listeners, including the fiction. Was submitted by a listener. That was submitted.
So if we had actually been paying attention to the emails, we would have gotten them.
No, but there's a separate little email for science or fiction suggestions that only come to me.
Wait. How do we get on that list?
This one was sent in by Andrew Bangsberg. The fiction was. How cool would that be, though, being able to genetically transfer the octopus's color-changing ability.
Cloaking.
I was actually just watching a video of an octopus that somebody had captured. A little, it was smaller than his thumbnail, and he raised it in an aquarium. Yeah. And it was amazing to see it, like the colors just sort of undulating over it so quickly.
Bob, you're right. It's not just that it's slowly changing to match its environment. It could actually change it very quickly. As you're saying, Rebecca, like the one thing that they've filmed them doing, I don't know if you've ever seen this film, of like producing bands of white
Yes.
undulating up the tentacles, like the background red tentacles. It's like a flashing neon sign almost of warning saying, keep away, you know, I'm poisonous.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. What they found in terms of how this works is that the bottom layer of octopus skin is made up of cells called leucophores and is composed of translucent, colorless, reflecting protein. And it's very, you know, it's very odd. It could reflect all wavelengths of light pretty much at any angle.
Cool.
Yeah, it's a very interesting.
Really?
Yeah.
That's how it works. Wow.
It wasn't really clear to me from reading into this, but I was wondering, you know, how hard would it be? Do you just have to put in the gene for that protein, you know?
I would think you would need a lot of structural changes, though, for this to actually to work. You know, it's not just a simple little, you know, upgrade. You know, I think it would require some significant structural changes because, I mean, isn't there some weird link up with
Yeah, but I wasn't implying that with the way it was written. I mean, this could just be more when it's angry or it's frightened, it turns darker or something, you know. It could be more just with blood flow, you know, and not necessarily any kind of exquisite
right.
control. So, yeah, I mean, the octopus now has a totally evolved, tweaked out system. But
yeah.
if you just put the leucophores in the skin, wouldn't
okay.
that it
What's
would at least create the potential?
I'm glad I didn't read it that way then.
So good job, everyone. And thanks for sending
Yay.
All those suggestions.
Go us.
Everyone.
Thanks for sending them, but you weren't good
yeah.
enough.
No,
yeah,
weren't
you didn't
good
send
enough.
Them to me.
If All next right. time you'll just include your IQ at the top of the email, then Steve can find good ones so that maybe he can fool us next time.
Jay.
Yeah.
Give us a quote.
I have a quote sent in. The same quote was sent in by two listeners, and they both sent me this quote in February.
What are the odds?
Pretty good, probably.
They were sent in by Lyra Grace and J.D. Mack. And I think they got the quote off of XKCD, the webcomic.
Mm-hmm. I know him, too.
And
cool.
that comic is created and written and, believe, drawn by Randall Monroe. I'm going to read two quotes from him. One of them is the one that was sent in by the listeners, and the other one I found that I really like. Anyway, here's the first one. You don't use science to show you're right. You use science to become right. And then here's the one I like, and this is kind of off. Take wrong turns. Talk to strangers. Open unmarked doors. And if you see a group of people in a field, go find out what they're doing. Do things without always knowing how they'll turn out. You're curious and smart and bored, and all of you see is choices between working hard and slacking off. There are so many adventures that you miss because you're waiting to think of a plan. To find them, look for tiny intersecting choices and remember that you are always making up the future as you go. Randall Monroe!
I thought maybe that was like the president of NAMBLA.
I'd like to call that Monroe's Doctrine.
Monroe's Doctrine.
I think
up random doors, kids. It's cool. No, just go in. Just go in. Somebody on the street offers you candy, just take it.
Get in that car. Yeah. Talk to those strangers. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Here's some scissors. Why don't you go run with this?
You know, I thought I'd read an inspirational quote once, you know, and you had to turn it into the most horrible thing known to mankind. Thank you.
That's right. We have a couple announcements. One good, one kind of neutral. We'll do the kind of neutral one first. This is important, though. We have been getting a tremendous deal on our bandwidth over the last 5 years from Libsyn. We basically pay peanuts, and you know we were calculating our bandwidth usage. We have 120,000 downloads a week at 25 megabytes a show, pretty much on average. Yeah, so yeah, our bandwidth usage is about 150,000 gigabytes a year, which, if we had to actually pay at any kind of reasonable rate, we basically couldn't afford it. And Libsyn essentially is no longer going to let us get away with that. Essentially, they're going to be changing their terms of the contract.
I am altering the deal. Pray I don't alter it any further.
So essentially, we needed to do something with Libsyn in order to make this relationship work. And after a long, difficult discussion, considering multiple options, it was long, and we did believe you, we didn't like to do any of this. That what we're going to do is we're going to start embedding some Audible ads, you know, advertisements for Audible.com into the Skeptic's Guide. It'll be as inobtrusive as possible.
Unobtrusive.
It'll be as unobtrusive as possible.
Inobtrusive.
But but yeah, so it'll essentially allow us to keep affording the ability to host all this incredible bandwidth that we have. So again, we're partly victims of our own success, but that's a good thing, and in fact also help fund the podcast a little bit as well. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is TAM 8. You know, Nexus is now over, so now the next thing in front of us is the Amazing Meeting 8, Las Vegas, Nevada, July 8th through 11th. And of course, the SGU will be there. We will be recording live shows on Friday and Saturday morning from 8 to 9. There will be two science-based medicine workshops that you can sign up for. We will be doing the SGU dinner like we have in previous years.
I'm doing a panel as well.
To be clear though, Rebecca, you're doing a workshop on the Thursday workshop. Friday night, 7 to 9, it's also a separate thing that's optional that you have to pay for, is the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe dinner. It'll be in the same room, you know, a buffet kind of deal as we did last year. We sold out last year, so if you want to be sure to get a seat, register early. Registration will be through the JREF this year, so it's actually an official JREF event now. You'll register like you do for all the other events for the Amazing Meeting 8.
Steve, what about at the SGU dinner? Are we going to be auctioning stuff? Are we going to be...
Well, we're talking about that. No official plans yet, so I don't want to say anything, but we may be doing some other special events at the dinner. Okay. But we'll all be there. A lot of our skeptical and podcasting friends will be there as well. And we are there to just... That's our 2 hours where we are doing nothing but meeting our listeners and talking with people.
Okay.
It'll be a lot of fun. Well, thank you all for joining me again this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Excellent. Happy 250, everyone.
Happy 250. Yay. And next week is our 50-year anniversary. We'll talk about that as well.
I know what I'm getting you guys.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and SkeptChick.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.